home for me. But I was about to meet the people who served my sister Nettle, those she had chosen and trained. I straightened my shoulders and patted my hair flatter, but felt it pop up again. I did not need to brush my elderling garb. It hung, sparkling and immaculate, on me. As we drew closer to the dock, I made myself smile. I lifted my hand and waved to them. Purr took my other hand. "He would be proud of you," he whispered. Kelsingra was as astonishing as Purr said it would be. But it exhausted me. Everything was a whirl and a blur. Elderlings, both real and shadowy, were celebrating in the streets. We were welcomed as if we were royalty, and it was Purr who reminded me that I was. The members of Nettle's special skill coterie had their walls up so tight against the city that I could barely sense them. I tried to copy them, but perhaps some residue of serpent spit in my blood made me more vulnerable. All the beauties and wonders of Kelsingra could not charm me enough to make me remain in that cacophony of voices and whirling rainbow of color and sights. Clancy, the woman who led the coterie, gave me a tea of mint and valerian with a dark, bitter aftertaste. As she had warned me it might, it deadened me to the voices. But it also freed my sadness from where I had hidden it. Even during the dinners and entertainments, even when the two paragon dragons demanded to see me, even as I gave my rehearsed speech thanking them for helping to free me, tears would roll. The dragons told me that my father would be remembered as a friend to dragons and a vengeance taker. As long as dragons flew and serpents swam, he would be remembered. They regretted that they had not been able to eat his body and preserve all his memories. I laughed aloud at this in horror. Fortunately, they took that as my joy at their wish to have made my father their dinner. Then that was over, and I slept. But even sleep was not rest, for the distant voices tugged at me. Even when I rowed in a tiny boat on a cable across the river to the village, I heard the voices and knew the story of the shattered bridge in the river below us. There on the other side, the rest of the coterie had been busy with Rainwilders who were touched. They had been there for 2 months and had, I was told, worked miracles for people. 4 pregnancies were attributed to their putting their hands on women's bellies and opening something for them. A young man who had been dying from his inability to breathe normally had been revived and healed and celebrated his son's 3rd birthday. All of these joyous things were attributed to my father's wishes to bring them there. But they could no longer stay, because I had come there. I was resting in a lovely chamber where fish swam in the walls and leapt over my head. They made me ill just watching them. King Rain and Queen Malta had come to visit me on the day that Clancy told them we all had to leave. Only the teas I am giving her are keeping her sane and preventing her from slipping away altogether. You would call it drowning in memories. If we keep her here longer, she will fall into unresponsiveness. We must take her home. "Will you travel through the pillars as you did to come here?" Queen Malta asked, and they nodded. Beloved was still being Amber. She was sitting by my bedside in a chair. She held my hand in her gloved one. The tea and the sadness it gave me had renewed my dislike of her. I didn't like the touch, but she helped to anchor me. Purr had been best at that. He was so immune to the magic that I could hide inside him. But when I had told Clancy that, she had frowned and said that what I was doing was drawing off his strength, and that doing so put him in danger. So Clancy had separated us. "It's too dangerous for Bee to travel that way," Amber objected. Clancy was very calm as she said, "The skill mistress has decided that the whole coterie will travel with you and take all of you back to Buckkeep at once."
"I don't agree,"
Amber objected in Fool's voice, and Clancy replied, "It is neither your decision nor mine. Tomorrow we depart." I drew a deep breath of relief and sank into sleep. I did not bother to listen to the rest of their long farewells to the king and queen of the elderlings. I would see my sister soon. And Riddle.
Chapter 45. A Princess of the Farseers.
A grey man is singing in the wind. He is as grey as storm clouds, as grey as rain on a window pane. He is smiling as the wind blows past him. His hair and his cloak stream in the wind and tatter away. He tatters with them until only his song is left. I woke from the dream smiling. It is a promise and a good one. It will happen.
Dream Journal of B. Farseer.
I was royal now. I did not much like it. I understood why my father had tried to spare me from it. The journey through the skill pillar was uneventful. The horrid procession to it and the endless farewells and the dragons trumpeting overhead that preceded it were all extended agony. Oh, how stiffly I smiled and curtsied and thanked everyone. I had begged for Purr, and they let me have him. I held tight to his hand on one side and to Clancy on the other, and through we went like a string of beads. Only to discover that on the other side there was a welcoming party gathered, and there would be another procession and a feast that night, followed by music and dancing. I held tight to Purr's hand as they announced it. It was only when he said, "I feel dizzy," that I knew what I was doing. I let go of him then. Riddle had been standing beside me on the other side. He suddenly stepped between us and put one hand on my shoulder and one on Purr's. We both felt better for that touch. So many things happened that day. I met my niece, formally, in front of everyone, with a curtsy on a dais. She was draped all in lace with pearls on it and had a tiny red face. Hope screamed through the entire introduction. Nettle looked very tired. Afterward, we had to have tea and some food in a room full of ladies with extravagant dresses and too many perfumes. When I said I was rather tired, they showed me a room and said it was mine. The beautiful wardrobe Revel had made for me was there, with my old things in it. But when Caution came in and curtsied to me, I shrieked and then cried and could only ask her if she was unhurt, if it was really her, for I had been convinced the raiders could not have left her alive. She began to sob too, until the woman who had brought me there threatened to call for a healer to drug away our hysteria. I lost my temper and ordered her to go away. Caution latched the door behind her, and we wept alone until we managed to stop. Caution said she was well recovered, but I knew she wasn't. She had only arrived the day before I did. She was to be my maid here, she told me, as my sister had not wished life in Buckkeep Castle to be too great a change. But then she told me that Buckkeep Castle was immense and full of people, and she was almost afraid to leave the rooms at night. And what was she, a simple country girl, doing in such a place? I said I wondered the same thing for myself. She hugged me so hard I thought my ribs would crack. She helped me out of my elderling garb, and then we had a tedious time of dressing me in crispy, rustling skirts that she assured me were the latest style from Jamalia. I did not have lice, but she said that was sheer luck, for my hair was all tangles and mats, despite Spark's best efforts. I left a great deal of it in her comb. There followed a gathering in a room, and walking into a great hall full of people and trying to eat dinner on a stage. Shun was seated three chairs away from me. She was Lady Shine now, in clothing even more gorgeous than she had worn at Withywood's. I wondered if she still scattered it on the floor of her room when she undressed. We looked at each other once, and then away. I slept in a big bed in my new room, and dreamed that I opened my wardrobe and Revel looked out from the mirror and thanked me for the kerchiefs I had given him. I woke weeping. Caution came into the room. She slept in the bed beside me. We held hands all night. Was it the next day we had a ceremony to mourn my father? I burned a lock of my hair, for Nettle said I could not spare more than that. Was it that first day when I was presented to the king and queen? The days were tangled and confused, like a neglected yarn basket. Every day there was someone I must meet, and a meal to share, and people telling me formally how sad they were that my father was dead. There was a private meeting with Lady Ketrickan, who had taken to her bed as soon as she heard of my father's death, and had not emerged from her room since. She was pale and rather old. She gave me a very sad smile and said,
"Look at those golden curls. I wonder if Verity could have given me a little girl like you.
if we had had more time. That seemed very awkward to me. I was taken to see Lady Shine. I am sorry for your loss, I told her, in front of the maids attending her, and Lady Simmer, who followed me about. And I for yours, she replied. And what else was there to say? I do not think we even wanted to look at each other. Neither of us wanted to speak of what had happened to us, and after a time I excused myself, saying I was still very weary. And that obligation was done. At meals, we nodded in passing. One morning, I asked to see Purr, and was told I did not have time that day, but was assured that he was being honoured and had been given a matched pair of black horses from Buckkeep's best stock and offered a good position in the stables. When I asked if he had the care of Pris, Lady Simmer did not know, but said she would make certain that Pris was given over to his care, if that was important to me. It was. Nettle and Riddle tried to have a quiet dinner with me, but the baby and the baby's nurse and two of Nettle's ladies and Lady Simmer and one of Riddle's men could not be excluded, and so I sat very straight and we talked of how nice the blackberry tart was. Later, when only the nurse was there, Nettle told me that soon I would become one of the Queen's ladies, but I should not fear, for Queen Eliania was actually very kind, and Nettle was determined to see that I learned everything that she, unfortunately, had not been taught. To that end, there would be a special tutor for me. Lant? I asked, and I did not know if I hoped or dreaded that. Lord Fitzvigilant has other duties, I am afraid, but Scribe Diligent has taught many a noble child, and will school you in deportment and protocol, as well as numbers and letters. I nodded to that and glanced at Riddle to see pity and worry in his eyes. Beginning the next day, there were hours when I must be with my tutor, and more hours when I must attend the Queen. I must learn the names of every Duke and Duchess and their children, and the colours of their houses, and their heraldry. Every evening meal had to be taken downstairs in the dining hall, sitting to the left of Riddle and Nettle. Daily, I spent part of the morning attending the Queen. I had been warned to sit very straight and embroider or knit or weave, as she did, and listen to the chatter of her ladies. They put me in a place next to Lady Shine. We both kept too busy to speak to each other. But on the third day, Queen Eliania bade us continue with our work while she took more rest. The moment the door closed behind her, I felt like a flung bread crust in a flock of chickens. Such pretty golden curls, Lady B. Will you allow your hair to grow now? Is it true you were kept as a slave in jail, said? That question came in a scandalized whisper. I have not seen before that stitch you used on the pansies. Can you teach it to me? Lord Fitzvigilant tells us you are the bravest little girl he has ever met. Such a charming man. Do you think that you and he would like to join Lady Clement and me for gaming one evening? We have heard so little of your adventures. Lady Feckens smiled avariciously. It makes me shudder to think of a little girl like you and poor dear Lady Shine in the clutches of such monsters. Lady Violet, with a sideways glance at Shun, added, Lady Shine has told us almost nothing about the day that Withywoods was attacked. You must have been terrified. Chalcedians, we are told, have no respect for the women when they raid and loot, and they had her for many days and nights. I glanced at Shun. Her chin quivered once, and then she clutched her teeth. It was a difficult time I do not wish to speak about, she said stiffly. I knew then that she was not well liked in this room, and that Lady Violet would shame her if she could. Lady Violet was lovely, but not as beautiful as Shun with her green eyes and curling hair, nor was her figure as good. I was beginning to learn about such things at court. Lady Violet pecked at me. But surely little Bee could tell us some tales. However did you manage to buy your lives in the hands of such ruthless men? She said it as if there were a nasty secret she could wheedle out of me. I fixed her with a gaze. I am Lady Bee, I reminded her, and several of the other women tittered. One gave me a sympathetic look, and then put her eyes on her sewing. I tried to find the carrying voice Hap used when I added, I lived because Shine protected me. Ill, she nursed me, Cold, she shared her blankets with me. She saw that I had food. At great risk to herself, she helped me try to escape. My voice had the knack of it. I paused. She killed for me, and escaped to find out my father and put him on my trail. She has the heart of a lioness. I considered her wide green eyes, then turned my smile on Lady Violet. If you cut her, I bleed. And if I bleed, Princess Nettle will know of it.
Well, Lady Violet exclaimed haughtily, the kitten has claws.
The tittering laughter was the clucking of hens called to thrown grain. The bee has a stinger, I corrected her. Our eyes met and held. She sneered at me, but I smiled. She had no walls at all. Rather than my tale, we would all much more enjoy hearing of your tryst last night, with the gentleman who wears a green doublet and far too much oil in his hair. Shun's hand flew to her mouth to hold back not a scandalized gasp, but a delighted laugh.
It isn't true!
Lady Violet rose, her skirts rustling like birds' wings, and swept from the room. At the door she glared at me and said,
This is what comes of admitting common borns to a circle of noble ladies.
She scuttled out the door. I could not allow that to hurt me, or Shun. I forced a giggle. She runs like a startled hen, does she not? I said to Shine. A ripple of nervous laughter spread out from my flung stone. Lady Violet was popular, but not liked, I saw. I was certain we'd cross swords again. Shun was sitting taller. She carefully set aside her needlework in a basket at her feet, rose far more gracefully than Lady Violet had, and held out a hand to me. Come, little cousin, shall we walk in the women's garden? She asked me. I set my own needlework aside. I am told that the violets there are actually fragrant. This time their laughter was bolder. We left the room, and none of them followed. Still she glanced back and, Hurry, she said. We went, not to the women's garden with its herbs and blossoms, but up to a tower-top garden of potted shrubs and statuary and benches. She used a key to open the door. For an hour we walked about it, speaking little. When she left, she gave me the key. This was my father's key. This is a good place to be alone. What of you? I asked her, and she smiled at me. While my father lived, I had a protector at court. Now I have none. Your brother? He is uncomfortable with me, she said it stiffly. Sadly, she added, and I with him. I would rather face men with knives than that circle of bitches with their needles, I said bluntly. She laughed aloud, and when she turned back to me, the wind had put color in her cheeks, and I saw something of the old Shun in the set of her mouth. The green doublet is sharper than any knife I've ever held, and I promise you that I will use it well. She held up her hand, fingers curved, and said, Time for the lioness to show her claws. And she left me there, on the rooftop garden, with the wind blowing the scent of jasmine, and the clouds running like ships before a wind. My life began to have a pattern, a hectic one. I saw nothing of Spark or Purr. Beloved had donned yet another guise. He was now known as Lord Chance. He would call on me once a day at his appointed time, and we would talk. He always asked if I was well, and I always replied I was. There was a complicated story of who he was now, and how he had joined my father and Lant to save me. I couldn't be bothered with it. He brought me little gifts, a carved wooden acorn with a secret compartment under the cap, and a doll dressed all in black and white, and a better pipe than the one we had made on the river. Once he said, as he left me,
It will get better, B. Someone else will have a disaster or a triumph, and people will not watch you so closely. Nettle's baby will become less fussy, and Nettle will not be so tired. When Queen Eliania's child is born, you can blissfully fade into the background of Buckkeep politics. You will be able to become B again.
It was not an encouraging thing to hear, but every morning another day started, and every night I put another day behind me. The most serious day was one when Clancy escorted me to Nettle's chamber up in a tower where the Queen's own coterie was accustomed to meet. They were one of six coteries that lived in or very near to Buckkeep, one for each prince, one for the king. Nettle's coterie? Far too many, I thought. I felt a bit offended when Clancy reported to my own sister on my level of skill talent and how she had needed to dose me with elf bark in Kelsingrad. I learned that some of my dreams, not my white dreams but my regular ones, had been leaking out of my mind at night and disturbing coterie members. With an apology for being so bold, Clancy suggested that I should be dosed daily with elf bark until I was either able to control my wild skilling or the skill was quenched in me. Nettle told her that she would take her thoughts under advisement and consider them. When I spoke to Nettle as my sister, asking if I did not have some say in this, she replied, "Sometimes an adult must decide what is best for a youngster, Bee. In this, you will have to trust me." But that was hard. Yet it was not all unfortunate things. Hap Gladheart came to my room very late one night, escorted by Lant and Lord Chance. Caution was scandalized until I reminded her that Hap was my foster brother. He played some silly songs for me and soon had even Caution giggling. Then Lord Chance told me that, when I felt able, I should tell Hap every detail of what had befallen me, for it was Buck history and should be preserved. I remembered my sister's words and told him that I would take his thoughts under advisement and consider them. Hap grinned and said, "I thought you might," and swept into the opening notes of a song. Days passed with dinners and introductions and then entertainments with other young nobles of my age that I should cultivate. Lady Simmer organized my social schedule. My brothers came to visit me, some with wives and children, a few at a time. I found that I scarcely knew any of them anymore. I loved them, but it was a distant love, the same they accorded to me. I watched them with Nettle and her child, their jests and their advice and their "do you remembers?" all harking back to a family I'd never been a part of. They were kind. They brought me the sort of gifts one would give to a young female relative. Riddle sat beside me for those visits. He spoke to me so that I had someone for a conversation, and taught me how to smile at strangers who loved me but had no idea of my ordeal, especially as I had no desire to share it with them. At such times, I was glad that Purr had suggested I erase my scars. When I spoke at all, I told them of seeing ships turn into dragons and moving figureheads and the wonders of Kelsingrad. I am sure they discounted half of it as a child's fanciful nonsense, and that was fine with me. I began to understand why my father wrote at night, and why he burned it afterward. There came a day when there was an unfilled morning, for the gravid queen had dismissed her ladies. I begged to be allowed to go out riding, and when that was granted, I insisted I would ride only Pris. As I dressed, I was dismayed to be informed that four other nobles of about my age and two of my sex would go with me. To my disdain, each would be accompanied by a groom on a mount, and some of their parents would attend us as well. Fitzvigilant and Lord Chance would ride alongside me. My heart rose when I saw that Purr was there, but he merely held Pris's head while my groom supervised me as I mounted my horse. It was more than I could bear. "I know how to get on a horse," I insisted, and even to myself I sounded petulant and spoiled. I did worse later. We were kept to a sedate pace that allowed the adults to converse and the youngsters to say insipid, dull things to me. Purr rode far behind us. I looked back and saw him, and for just an instant our gazes met. I leaned forward and told Pris, "Run!" Did I use the skill on her? I do not think so, but she leapt forth with a will, and we burst to the front of the group, and I urged her on. She flew. For the first time since I'd been taken, I'd felt as if I was myself, free and in control, even if I was on the back of a wildly galloping horse. There were shouts behind me and two shrieks, but I didn't care. We veered from the trail into the trees and up a steep hill. Down a gully she took me, through a muddy stream and up another steep bank. At first, I heard hoofbeats behind me, and then I didn't. On I went, clinging to Pris like a burr, and we were so glad of each other. We emerged from open forest onto a grassy hillside. Below us, meadowland unfurled like a green carpet, sheep scattered across it like spilled buttons. Pris halted, and together we breathed. When I heard another horse behind me and glanced back, it was all I had hoped for. Purr galloped up on a black mount, every bit as fine as they had promised he'd be given. He halted beside me and patted his horse's neck. "What's her name?" I asked him.
"Maybelle," he replied. He grinned at me, and then it faded. "Bee, we should go back. Everyone will be frightened for you."
"Truly?"
"Truly."
"A little longer away from them all. They are all so..." He waited. There wasn't a word that expressed how they looked at me and over my head, and that there was always, always someone standing there. "I never get to be alone." He frowned.
"You want me to leave you alone?"
"No, I can be alone with you here. You never look at me like I'm something odd in your soup."
He laughed, and I did too.
"How is your life? Are you well treated?"
His smile faded. "I'm a stable boy, one of many. The stable master tells me often not to be above myself. Yesterday he chided me and told me I must not have favourites among the horses. I had lingered too long at Priss's stall."
He lifted his hand and rubbed the back of his head.
"He rapped me with the handle of a broom when I said that Lance Mare needed more oats. Lord Fitz Vigilant to you, boy, and do not tell me my business."
He laughed at his own tale. I did not find it funny at all.
"And you?"
I sighed. "Lessons of all sorts. A great deal of changing my clothes, followed by sitting still and proper in itchy garments. Lady Simmer always trailing after me, correcting me, keeping me usefully occupied, always indoors.
Do you see much of Spack, Lant, and..."
He hesitated.
"Lord Chance?"
"Nothing of Spark. Lant and Beloved are almost as good as my father was at leaving me alone." Purr's eyes widened, and I wished I had not said it. But it was true. For all Beloved's nattering, I saw little of him except when he was nosing through my dream book or asking me questions.
"I miss them all," Purr said quietly.
"They do not come to see you?"
"Spark? Not at all. Lord Fitzvigilant and Lord Chance? Why saddle their horses, and Lant, Lord Fitzvigilant, always slips me a coin. We look at each other, and I know they wish me well, but there are always people watching, and appearances to be maintained."
He patted his pocket, and it jingled.
"I wonder if I will ever be given time to go and actually spend some of the coins."
I heard hoofbeats. We both straightened, and Purr reined his horse a little away from me, as first Lant and then Beloved rode out of the trees. They both looked flustered. Beloved rode close to me and said, very quickly,
"A fly stung your horse and she ran away with you. Purr came and caught her headstall. Purr, get off your horse and hold her reins, quickly!"
Sternly he added to me,
"Bee, you must never put Purr in such danger of rebuke again. You must look shaken when the others get here."
Purr did as he was told. Perhaps the anger burning inside me could make me look shaken. Every time I began to like Beloved at all, he did something to fan those flames. To hear they neglected Purr made me want to spit at him. I drew breath to tell him that. But here came two grooms and someone's father, all asking if I'd fallen, and the groom somberly suggesting a more sedate mount.
"Until the young lady has better riding skills."
We went by a roundabout way back to the level trail, and two of the mothers insisted that we must turn back, for they were very unsettled and did not want to witness another incident with
an unruly horse.
All the youngsters were looking at me with wide eyes. Purr dropped back again to the end of our procession. Later, Nettle called me in for
a word.
It was more than one word, and her baby cried, and she walked up and down, gently bouncing her, the whole time she was reminding me that I must bear myself with dignity now. I did not ask her if she had decided about my skill. Now was not a good time to remind her that I was willful in many ways. Riddle escorted me back to my chambers afterward. As he left me at the door, he said,
If it is any comfort, your father did not enjoy this aspect of his life either, but he managed it, and so must you.
I went to bed early that night, thinking that some of Dwalia's beatings had been easier to take than Nettle's lecture and disappointed face. As I did now, I set my walls well before I tried to sleep, to keep my nightmares in as much to keep others out. My window was dark and the castle quiet when I woke to distant music. For a time, I was still and listened, wondering who could be making music at such an hour and for whom. I could not identify the instrument, but the music suited my mood perfectly. It was lonely and yet not fully sad, as if being alone were not such a bad thing. I got up out of bed and donned a dressing gown. The door to Caution's nook was closed. She was a sound sleeper. I stepped into the corridor and hesitated. But no one had ever forbidden me to move alone in Buckkeep at night. I closed the door softly behind me. I listened, but could not determine where the music was coming from. I closed my eyes to better focus and walked away from my chamber and Nettle and Riddle's grand rooms at the end of the hall. Door after door I passed. From time to time I stopped to listen and get my bearings. Then I would go on. The music grew stronger. I came to a door and pressed my ear to it. I heard nothing. Yet when I stepped back from it, the music was loud. I argued with myself. My curiosity won. I tapped at the door. There was no response. I tapped again, louder, and waited. No response. I tried the door. It wasn't latched. I pushed it open to reveal a cozy chamber smaller than mine. There was a low fire burning in the hearth. Even in summer, the old stones of Buckkeep seemed chill. In front of the fire, in a cushioned chair with his short legs propped up on a padded stool, a round-faced man was skilling out the music he dreamed. I was utterly charmed by this and felt a lift of heart as if I had stepped into an old tale. A grey cat was asleep on his lap. She lifted her head.
"We are comfortable," she informed me.
"Does he always skill music when he sleeps?" I spoke softly. The cat just looked at me. Then the man opened his eyes and looked at me. He showed no surprise or alarm. His eyes were cloudy, like an old dog's. He had odd features, little eyes with fat eyelids and small ears tight to his skull. He licked his lips and left the end of his tongue out. Then he said,
"I was dreaming a song for Fitz's little girl. If I ever got to meet her."
"That would be me," I said, and ventured closer. He pointed to a cushion on the floor near his chair.
"You can sit on that if you want. It's Smokey's cushion, but he's sitting with me right now. He won't mind."
"Yes, I will."
I sat on the hearth and looked up at him. "Are you thick?" I asked him.
"They call me that, yes."
"My father wrote about you in his journals." A wide smile opened his face. He was simple, I realized.
"I miss him," he said. "He used to bring me candy and little cakes with pink sugar frosting on them."
"That sounds lovely."
"They were delicious. And pretty. I liked to put them in a row and look at them."
"I liked to put my mother's candles in a row and smell them, but never burn them."
"I have 4 brass buttons, and 2 wooden ones, and 1 made from shell. Do you want to see them?"
I did. I wanted simple things, like sharing buttons. The cat made a rumble, jumped off his lap, and arranged himself on the cushion. It hurt Thick to get up to open a cupboard and take his box of buttons out, and I knew that he was old. Walking was not easy for him, but his buttons were important. He brought their box back to his chair. His blanket had fallen to the floor. I picked it up and put it over his legs again. As he showed me each button, he told me the story of finding it. Then I asked him, "Can you teach me to make the skill music?" He grew very still.
"My music," he said very softly.
He was uncertain, guarded. I was quiet. Had I spoiled everything by asking for this? He held out his hand to me. I hesitated. Then I set my hand in it, and his fingers closed around mine. His touch hummed with power.
"We have to be very quiet," he told me. "I'm not supposed to let my music be loud."
He did something to my walls, and suddenly we were behind his in a very peculiar way.
"Now," he said, "this is how to make the music."
He smiled and said,
"We will start with the cat's purr."
On that night, I gained a friend and a teacher. I was back in my bedroom well before dawn. He had taught me a music made of cat purrs, the creak of a rocking chair, and the low crackling of a fire. He had cloaked me in,
"See her not,"
before I crept back to my room. I was sleepy the next day. I didn't care. He was waiting for me when I returned that night. I helped him build
the tent,
as he called it, that was stouter than any skill wall I'd ever managed. He had saved some gingerbread from earlier in his day, for all his meals were brought to him now. We shared that, and shared our cat purr music, adding more things to it. I felt honored when he put in me laughing at the cat as he danced after a dropped spool. It was more fun than I'd ever had with anyone in my whole life. Even better than the day my father had taken me to the market in Oaksby Water, for there were no slain dogs or stabbed beggars. We just played. For someone who had never had a playmate, it was astonishing.
Chapter 46. The Quarry.
The Six Duchies has many folk tales about people vanishing into a skill pillar, and many about people suddenly stepping out of one. In many of them, people are fleeing unjust punishment, and the stones give them sanctuary from their attackers. In ones in which foreign or peculiar folk appear, they grant wishes such as improved health. All those tales, I believe, are rooted in the inadvertent use of a skill pillar by someone who is untrained.
A History of the Skill Pillars in the Six Duchies and Beyond. Shade, Falstar.
Something is wrong with the moon.
I blinked my eyes. Yes, there was a moon. A moon in the darkness meant we were not inside the skill pillar anymore. Nor between skill pillars, wherever that between was. We were on the ground somewhere, and looking up at the moon. The crow was standing on my chest. As I stirred, she hopped off me and away. For an instant, moonlight ran down her scarlet feathers. Then she was gone. Cool night air was soft against my skin. Hard stone was under my back. I lowered my eyes from the moon and saw the skill pillar that had dumped me out. Beyond it, forest. This was not Kelsingrar.
"The moon,"
Night Eyes insisted. I lifted my eyes to it. Oh, it was nearly full. It had been full when we entered the pillar. Either we had come out of the pillar before we had left, or we had been inside it close to a month.
"Or longer."
"Where are we?" I asked aloud, to avoid thinking about days lost. Or months. Years? There were legends of people vanishing into standing stones and emerging years later, either unchanged or very, very old. I wondered if I had aged. I certainly felt older. Weaker. I imagined Nettle, an old woman, Bee, a mother. I sat up with a shudder.
"Where are we?" "Where we need to be. The only place left for us to be."
It took an effort to rise from my sprawl. I rolled onto my hands and knees and stood up. Above me, stars and the almost full moon. I looked up at sheer rocky walls, and beyond them,
the dark shapes of evergreen trees. I smelled water. I turned my head and followed the scent. My sandals gritted on sand and small pebbles. The ground sloped down slightly, and I came to an immense square pond of standing water. It smelled green. I knelt at the edge, cupped water, and drank some more. I sat back. I was still hungry, but having my thirst quenched also deadened a headache that I had simply been accepting. I looked around in slow recognition. The quarry. The place where the elderlings had once cut and carved blocks of skillstone. I was not far from the place where Verity had ended his days as a man. He had carved his dragon from gleaming black and silver stone and had risen as a dragon to defend the six duchies.
Exactly where we need to be.
No, I meant to touch the face of the pillar that would take us to Kelsingra.
I know, but this is where we need to be.
I pushed his words to the back of my mind. I had known this place once. It had changed greatly, and not at all. I tried to recall where Verity's shabby tent had been, where we had set a fire, where we had camped. The moonlight glinted on the thick, silvery veins in the rock. My meandering path took me between and past rejected blocks of memory stone. Once, elderling skill coteries had come here to select a stone and carve the creature that would become the repository of their memories and bodies. I suspected it had been an elderling tradition that was somehow shared with a few six duchies coteries. Perhaps somewhere in the walls of Kelsingra or in the memory blocks of Aslevjol, that tale was stored. I found Verity's old campsite. Next to nothing was left after all those years. I had hoped to find more, for we had left all behind when we fled it. What might have been there? The remains of Ketrikan's bow? A knife? A blanket? The night was chill, and I would have welcomed any additional covering. It was strange to have stepped from summer in a warm land to summer in the mountains.
Not much left of summer, I fear. Lift your head and sniff, brother. I smell the end of summer, and leaves soon to fall.
Is it possible we were in the stone that long?
Do you remember nothing of our passage?
The wolf seemed genuinely surprised.
Nothing at all. Not Verity? Not Shrewd? Not our passing brush with shade?
I was shocked. I stood very still, groping back. I remembered the rogues who had attacked us in the old city, and I remembered carelessly putting my hand on the wrong face of the skill pillar. I pushed at my memory.
There you are, my boy. Leave him be. This is not his place, not his time for this. He has a task. Present that pin, and you will ever be welcome into my presence.
I had been lying on my back, looking up at a moon approaching full. Had I imagined those touches of mine's against mine? Did I pretend it to myself now? Weariness swept over me in a wave.
Something is very wrong with us. Something like a sickness, but not.
The pillar journey. I felt this way that time I left Aslevjol and was lost in the stones for a time.
No, this is something else,
the wolf insisted. I ignored that. How long? At least a month we had wandered between the pillars. It was likely that Bee and the others had reached Bingtown by now. It was like the slap of a cold wave. They would all think me dead. I had to let them know I lived. Then I could wait a few days to recover from my pillar journey. I would hike the old skill road to the abandoned market and its pillar. From there, I could enter that pillar and be back in Buck Duchy. How long before I was home? Before the next full moon? Time to let Dutiful know that I was alive, and as soon as Bee arrived, he would tell her. I wrapped my arms around myself and stood very still, gathering and centering myself. but I was abruptly aware of how thin I was. I felt my own ribs, and I was chilled to the bone. Make a fire first. With what? The old way, spinning a stick in a notch if I had to, but I suddenly felt I needed a fire, a light and a warmth to center myself, and then I would skill.
Verity suggested you not do that. Remember? Save that strength for your task. You'll need it.
No, I remember nothing of our passage. What task? I recall nothing.
You would if you truly wanted to remember.
Such an odd and irksome thing for him to say to me. His sulky words dangled between us as I went looking for wood. The moon gave a ghostly light to the rocky, barren quarry. Rain and wind had deposited branches and dead leaves, but little grew on the stony bone of the earth. My hunger had its claws set in my belly. Forest rimmed the quarry, and I moved along the edge of it, gathering dry wood. Insects chirred, and overhead bats frolicked in their pursuit of food.
Porcupine!
I sensed it at the same time Nighteye's excitement burst through to me. I had to smile. Never had he been able to control his fascination with the prickly creatures, and more than once I'd pulled quills from his nose and paws. I dropped my firewood and then selected one hefty piece from it. Porcupines rely on their quills for defense. They are slow-moving, one of the few game animals one can kill with a club. He kept his back and tail toward me as I tried to circle around him to where I could bash his head. By the time I killed him, I was winded. My dread at the work ahead before I could eat him almost outweighed my hunger. Almost. I made two trips to get my firewood and my dead porcupine to a place in the quarry near our old campsite. The woods around the quarry were dry as dust. I had no wish to set them alight with a careless spark, but I soon wished for any sort of a spark. My attacker's knife was my only large tool. I sharpened a stick for a fire drill and bored a hole in the driest piece of firewood. Then I began the endless task of spinning the stick between my palms, trying to build up enough warmth to make the wood smolder. I kept having to stop and rest. My shoulders and elbows ached abysmally.
"Try again,"
Nighteyes bade me softly, and I realized I had dozed off, hunched over my fire-making. I took up the stick in my silvered hand and began to spin it. It suddenly seemed a hopeless task, and I stabbed the stick savagely into my drill bed, shouting, "I just want a fire! Is that so much to ask? Fire!" It burst into flames, not a spark, not a trickle of smoke. Flames leapt up from both pieces of wood, and I scrabbled back and away from them. My heart was hammering in my throat.
"I didn't know we could do that."
"Neither did I."
"Don't let it die."
"No danger of that." I piled my wood onto it and watched it catch. The blaze pushed back the shadows and set the silver in the black stone sparkling. And my silvered hand gleamed in the light as I examined it, caught between wonder and dread. Practicality asserted itself. I plodded back to the forest's edge and came back with as much firewood as I could carry. Twice I did that, and then I turned to my meat. Skinning a porcupine is as ticklish a job as one might expect. The best way is to hang them spread-eagled and work on them, but I had no string and there were no trees in the quarry. In the end, it was worth the work and nuisance. He was as fat as a fall hog, and as I cooked the meat over the fire, it sizzled and sent up a fine, greasy smoke. I ate until I was full, and then slept, rolled in a dead woman's cloak. In the dawn's light, I woke under a wide blue sky. I built up my fire and ate more of my kill. I went back to the water, caught in the low end of the quarry, washed my hands, and drank deeply. With my belly full, I felt as if I could face the day. I recalled that there had been a stream not far from the quarry, a stream with fish. Starling. On the banks of that stream, I had told her that I did not love her, in an effort to be honest. Then we had joined our bodies in what had been little more than animal comfort, but had begun a strange and difficult relationship that would continue on and off for over a dozen years. Starling, in her fine striped stockings, with her proud, wealthy husband, listening as she sang the tale of our quest. Well, that was a verse, she had omitted, I thought, and even smiled. I returned to our fire. Motley was picking through the porcupine's entrails. She looked up with a bit of gut dangling from her silver beak.
Home?
She called hopefully. I spoke aloud. Today I sleep and catch fish, some to eat and some to dry. I don't plan to travel hungry again. 3 days of resting and eating, and we continue our journey.
It would be wiser to choose our piece of stone and begin now.
I crouched in stillness by my fire. I knew what the wolf was suggesting. I'm going home, not into a stone.
Fitz, long have we known it would come to this. How often did we dream of returning here and carving our dragon? Here we are, and it is time. And perhaps we have enough time and strength to do it. I would not wish to remain mired in stone like a girl on a dragon was.
I framed the thought sternly and spoke it aloud. I do not think we have reached that time. I'm not old, just tired. A bit of rest and...
Home?
Motley asked persistently.
Fool, Lant, Spark!
Lant is dead, I told her more sharply than I meant to. The wolf spoke more sharply.
Persist in being so stubborn, and you will be dead, and me with you.
My mind froze.
Going home,
Motley announced. Soon, I told her.
Now,
she parried. She ripped a last bit of gut from the porcupine. It wrapped around her silver beak. She deftly pulled it free with one foot, arranged it, and then gulped it down. She preened her feathers, blue, black, and scarlet.
Goodbye,
she added, and lifted into the sky. I stared after her. It's a long flight, I shouted. Did she have any idea where we were? She circled the old quarry, flying low over the blocks of rejected stone and the piles of rubble from long-ago works. At the low end was the rainwater pool. She skimmed it and, as I spun to follow her flight, she flew straight into the skill pillar. I feared I would run to a broken and flopping bird, but she vanished smoothly. I didn't know she could do that, I said. I hope she emerges intact.
Not her first journey through the stones, and she has skill on her beak.
True. I could not help her, but my heart sank that I might never see her again. I reminded myself I had a plan of my own for my journey. I made several trips for firewood. I roasted the porcupine's bones until they cracked and I could get at the marrow. Then it was time to fish. I had not tickled fish in a long time. I went to the creek and found a spot where I could lie on my belly, where dangling plants overshadowed an undercut bank, where the sun would not cast my shadow on the water. I was pleased that I remembered so well how it was done, and even more pleased with two fine, fat trout. I put a hooked willow wand through their gills and kept them in the water until I was rewarded with two more. Two to eat tonight, and two to smoke or dry for my journey. I felt very satisfied.
Are you sure you don't remember any of what Verity counseled you?
I stumbled into the stone and out of it again. I've no recall of our passage.
You were deep in the skill. Verity found you. He is a large fish there now, swimming in those deep currents. He told you to carve your dragon and not delay. King Shrewd was there, smaller and thinner. Shade was with him. They wished you well in that effort.
I spoke eventually. I don't recall that at all. I truly wish I did.
I recall it for you. He warned you not to delay it. He nearly failed. Had you not brought Kettle with you, and had she not been who and what she was, there would have been a half-finished dragon and a dead king, and probably the Out-Islanders would hold Buckkeep Castle now. We are not gambling for such high stakes as he was. Only your life and mine. I will think well on it tonight. Fitz, I do not want to cease being. Make us a dragon. Give me that vestige of life. Let me smell the night air again. Let me hunt. Let me feel the cold of night and the heat of the sun. There was such hunger in his words, I felt selfish. He experienced the world through me, but my senses were but a shadow of what his had been. Night Eyes, what are you? He paused. I am a wolf. You need to be reminded of that. You were a wolf. What are you now? A ghost that lives inside me? A mixture of my memories and me thinking what you might say or do? That seems unlikely, for I remember Verity, and you do not. And I sojourned with B, apart from you, and she heard me. I wish I'd had more time to speak of you to her, to tell her the tales I promised she would know. I was not derelict in that. She knows much of our time together. Much of my life. I am glad of that. And I. So, you do not imagine me. You live in me. Yes, and if you die, I die with you. I want to go home, Wolf. I want to see Bee. I need to be with her, and I need to make reparations for the sort of father I was. I need a chance to do better with her. That is what you told Verity. I will repeat what he said. Someone else will do that for you, and you must trust that they will do it well, as he did with his son, the son he never met. What is this urgency to carve a stone? My brother, something eats you from within. I feel it. Stop hiding it from yourself. I was too long in the stone, that is all. I ran my silvered hands down my ribs, felt the jut of my hip bones. You think I have worms? I know you do. They are eating you faster than your body can heal itself. I thought deeply as I left the stream and made my way back to the quarry. My fire had burned low. I raked coals out and rebuilt the rest of it. I baked two of the fish on the coals and ate them. I looked at the other two. I was still so hungry. I could catch more tomorrow for my journey. I raked out more coals and set the fish on them. When will you decide? Soon. I almost heard his sigh, the same sigh he would give when he wished to go hunting at night and I would stay in, morosely writing on paper that I would burn before morning. I poked at the fish. Almost done. Eating raw fish could give me worms. I smiled bitterly. Would those worms eat the parasites that the wolf insisted I already had? With two sticks, I turned the fish over on the coal bed. Be patient. It began to rain. I felt two warm drops fall onto my wrist. No. Blood. My nose was bleeding. I reached up and pinched it shut.
What if it doesn't stop?
It always stops.
And your body always heals itself.
After a time, I let go of my nose. No more blood. See? No response. Wolf, are you still with me? A sulky acknowledgement. A thought came to me. If you had to, if something happened to me, could you go to B and be with her the rest of her life?
I would be the shadow of a shadow.
Could you do it?
Perhaps. if her walls were down and everything was right. But I would not.
Why not?